You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 16 of the City of Man podcast, a show where a conservative evangelical political scientist and a progressive evangelical philosopher try to have an informed discussion on matters of political theory and the politics of the day. I am that progressive evangelical philosopher. My name is Edward Song, and I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And the conservative evangelical political scientist who is with me is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Coyle, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing pretty well myself. The semester has started up with, for both of us, I guess?
We're about a fifth of the way through, 3 or 4 weeks in.
Is that right already?
Yeah, it's going fast.
We find ourselves in an interesting time to be running a politics podcast, as we're in the middle of an election season. And you, in particular, are also in the middle of some exciting things going on in Missouri politics. You have a gubernatorial election that I guess has achieved a certain degree of national attention, Missouri being a pretty prominent swing state and all.
In some ways, it's like a little picture of the presidential election or gubernatorial election. We have sort of an evil Democrat running against a fake Republican. And that's not really an exaggeration. We have a Democrat who is, you know, a longtime public servant. Say he's evil. By all accounts, he's fine at what he does. Who's received the endorsement of basically every major conservative organization in the state, largely because the guy running on the Republican side is a lifelong Democrat who had sort of a political conversion experience, I guess, 8 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that, within the last eight years, because he was actually a supporter of Barack Obama back in 2008. So it's interesting times. Still sort of thinking about who, if anyone, I will vote for in the gubernatorial race. I'm just hoping it doesn't tank the down tickets, because our other state offices, we've got some phenomenal conservative candidates running. The gentleman who was the attorney for Hobby Lobby is running for attorney general of the state. He's a professor at Mizzou, University of Missouri, and is running, and I think will be a great attorney general. But you have sort of the coattail effect, where whoever wins at the top tends to affect all of the down ticket items. So we're trying to balance that well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your election's a funny one. The Democratic nominee used to be a Republican, and the Republican nominee used to be a Democrat. Just by way of full disclosure, I actually know the Republican nominee. He's a pretty good friend. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, which is when I met him. He was like my best friend at Oxford, and became a Navy SEAL. Eric Reitens is his name. He became a Navy SEAL, started a nonprofit organization dedicated to doing veterans work. And
is very good with an automatic weapon.
Yes.
At least according to his commercials.
A lot of attention for his commercials. One involves boxing. He was a boxer at Oxford. Two of them involve big guns and explosions. And, you know, I'll say this for Eric. He's a friend, so I'm biased. I think he's a great guy. It's true that, he was wooed by the Democratic Party prior to 2008 to run for Congress. And he was, you know, he did go to Barack Obama's, the Democratic Party nomination in 2008. I can say this for a fact. Shortly after even before that, he was never really enthusiastic about Barack Obama.
That's not what the video of him cheering at the convention suggested that I saw.
I can tell you that before that election, he was more a supporter of Hillary than Obama. He didn't like Obama. He thought Obama hadn't really accomplished anything. And And then after the election, I think in some conversations with him, he became really, really critical. And he was sort of talking about, I mean, his political conversion wasn't just for show, or at least in conversations with him before he ran, I knew that he's becoming more conservative since the time that I knew him. So anyways.
And to be fair, I don't know the gentleman. I've never met him. I know what you've told me about him and what I've, you know, read and seen on TV. So that's the full extent of my involvement here.
Interesting times in the show me state for sure.
Yeah. Do you guys have any elections, any major elections coming up this year? I assume one of your senators must be up.
Yes. And there are some congressional elections in my district. There's a relatively long time Democratic representative who represents our district, and she's retiring. So her seat is coming up. And I believe, yes, and there's also a Senate race.
But are the outcomes in doubt at all?
I don't think so. I mean, so to be honest, I'm not particularly tuned into the political goings on here. I mean, part of that is that I still don't really feel like a Californian. But part of that is also a sense that the elections are relatively safe.
Right.
In some ways, Santa Barbara is – it's kind of – I maybe it's historically progressive, but there are also a lot of blue-collar working-class communities as well. Like the place where I live, the place where Westmont is extremely affluent and conservative. So it's kind of funny. So I don't know exactly what the congressional race looks like, but I suppose that – that could possibly be up in the air. But in any case, you know, we're recording this episode in the middle of September. We're in the midst of a busy political season. The intensity of the presidential election, anyways, continues to wax and wane. Currently, it looks like the race for president is tightening up again, with Trump now trailing Hillary Clinton by only a few percentage points nationally. We're going to continue to talk about the election, the presidential election in the coming weeks. But we thought it might be a nice way to kick off the presidential election season by taking a step away from the messiness of the election itself and to try to dedicate an episode towards the institution of the presidency itself and the shape and contours of the executive office as our founders imagined it.
Yeah, so this is one of the areas that I'm really interested in as a political scientist and as someone who likes political theory, even though it's not really the area the founders spent the most time discussing. They were much more interested in Congress in legislation. There's a reason, you know, Congress is Article One. It's longer than the rest of the main text of the Constitution put together. You know, excluding the amendments.
Is there a reason for that? I mean, is it just because they thought that the legislative functions were more central and important? Or?
Well, they are. I mean, Congress is the leadership branch of government. That's the idea. That's the point behind it. And they were concerned that it would get out of control. They were concerned that some of the things they were seeing go on in state legislatures would start to happen at the national level. So you have kind of infamous examples in states like Pennsylvania, where the legislature starts overturning jury decisions, and the legislature starts, you know, stripping governors of power. So they wanted Congress to be in charge. They believed firmly in representation, and that is where true representation happens, right? Congress is supposed to be a little picture of the nation, all gathered in one place, governing us. But they also wanted to make sure that it didn't go too far. They didn't want it to become tyrannical. Legislatures can be just as tyrannical as anything else. So most of their time, most of their discussion was spent sort of arguing through what Congress is going to look like. But they did spend a little bit of time on the president and what the presidency should be, which is what we're going to talk about today. The two big sources for this from the founding era that we tend to focus on are the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. So these are the people who were friendly to the Constitution on the Federalist side and the people who were opposed to the Constitution on the Anti-Federalist side. The Constitutional Convention meets and does its thing and sets the somewhat arbitrary rule that they have to convince 9 states to accept the Constitution before it takes place. Why 9 states? Well, just because that's the number they picked.
9 out of 13.
Yeah, and there's no special reason there, and it's a somewhat well, I guess unconstitutional, somewhat illegal decision, because they call for special conventions rather than just kicking it over to existing state legislatures, because they know that the state legislatures are going to vote no. They're not going to vote themselves out of power. So debates take place in the big states by some shenanigans on the part of the Federalists. It manages to get passed in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. Virginia passes the Constitution when George Washington basically steps in and promises that there will be a Bill of Rights. He stakes his personal reputation on it, and the Constitution passes there. And then the major battle takes place in New York. New York is where most of the debates happen. It's where we have a sort of series of pamphlet wars going on between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. A couple of debaters go on the circuit. John Jay and Melanchthon Smith make a swing around the major population centers of New York, giving a series of debates. And we get in the New York newspapers the series of papers that come to be known as the Federalist Papers, which always shames me a little bit. They're not particularly easy to read for a modern reader, but they were written as letters to the editor. They were designed to be read by the common people. So if you've ever started reading them and thought, man, this is a slog, you should be a little bit ashamed, because they're not designed to be difficult. I think it's just our education system has been in a slow decline for the past 300 years. Anyway, that bit of commentary aside, the Federalist Papers are the result, along with some of the Anti-Federalist Papers. The Anti-Federalist Papers, we don't know as much about the authors. They're gathered from sort of up and down the colonies. They often wrote under pseudonyms, and because their side lost, we usually don't know who they are. So we'll be discussing one called Cato 5. We don't know who Cato was, just that he took the pseudonym Cato, referencing the Roman nobleman who was very Republican in his view of the world. So the Federalist Papers, the section on the presidency is Federalist 67 through 77. Again, that's only, 11 papers out of the entire set focused on the presidency. The vast majority of them pay attention to Congress. But these 10 papers give us kind of a constitutional overview. So they take each part of the Constitution, each part of Article 2, and walk through what it means. And since have come to be kind of the standard interpretation of what the presidency in its basic constitutional form is supposed to look like. So they start off by arguing that, this is not a monarchy. The president is very, very different from what European monarchs have, even though it is, one person. One of the big discussions at the Constitutional Convention was whether there should be more than one president. Should there maybe be a president from each region of the country, one from the north, one from the south, and then one either from the west or from the mid-Atlantic. There was some discussion about that. The Federalist Papers say no, one is the right way to go. You can't have three different people trying to administer the government, but that doesn't mean that he's a king. There are still strict limits put in place on his office. And then Federalist 68 tackles the Electoral College. And I suspect you will disagree with me on this. I think the Electoral College is the most brilliant part of our entire Constitution. It is one of the few places I let myself be sort of openly partisan in class. I tell my students that I will not grade them down if they disagree with me about the Electoral College, but I will judge them morally. And of course, they have to know how it works. If they don't know that, I'll grade them down. But basically, the Electoral College is the gathering of electors who pick the president. Each state gets as many electors as it has representatives in Congress. So California has, 55 electors, I think? So 53 representatives, 2 senators. So 55 electors. Missouri, I believe, has 10. We used to have 11, but we lost one at the last census. The defense, the original defense behind this, according to the Federalist Papers, is that this gives the chance to provide a popular input. So there's a popular voice, a popular element to it, but involves wise men actually choosing. Right, so you have sort of the aristocrats and the Democrats kind of coming together, where the democracy, the people, will choose a state legislature, which will then choose electors. Those electors, through that multiple choosing process, then by definition are going to be the wisest and the most virtuous and so on, who will then deliberate and pick a president.
Yeah, because we know that Democratic elections always produce the most wise and virtuous.
Right. Well, yeah. So again, they are explicitly not trusting a direct Democratic election.
Yep.
There's multiple layers of remove there, and that way they can say, look, if there is a problem with the electors that you pick, take it up with your state legislature. Right. Don't blame anyone really but yourselves, but also your state legislature. That's what's supposed to happen. That's not the result, obviously. Once the popular vote is introduced, that goes out the window. And I forget which election took the first popular vote, but it was pretty early on. I think it was Jefferson. I think it was Jefferson and Adams when they did the first popular vote.
Oh, is that right? So prior to that, the state legislature
Still the state legislature picks. That's still how it works, but they started instituting a popular vote in the state to send the signal to the state legislature which electors to pick. I might have my dates off. It may not have been Jefferson. It may have been a little bit later than that.
Well, but prior to that, state legislators would pick representatives directly, and they could pick whoever they wanted.
They still can. So the state legislatures can still pick whoever they want unless they have set rules for themselves.
Yeah.
Saying that they won't, but yeah, so...
And then those electors can vote for whoever they want.
They can vote for whoever they want. Again, some states have passed laws saying, hey, if you're an elector from our state, you've got to vote the way our state voted in the popular vote. Those laws, to the best of my knowledge, have never been challenged, but they absolutely will not hold up. You cannot bind an elector with the state law. Electors are federal government officials. They are free to vote however they want.
Completely independent of the popular vote.
Completely independent of the popular vote. Again, there are state laws that say that's not the case, but those laws would never hold up to constitutional scrutiny.
But in practice, that's what they always do.
No, there's almost always at least one elector who will vote against the way his state wanted him to vote. So in 2004. 2000 and 2004, the last two I remember it happening. One of those elections, the elector from Washington State refused to vote the way they were supposed to vote out of some kind of environmentalist principle. I don't remember the details there. And then in the other election, the elector from the District of Columbia refused to vote just on principle because D.C. was not a state and they were protesting.
Uh-huh.
So again, you cannot bind an elector. They can vote whoever they want to vote for, whoever they want to vote for.
So the popular vote is a total fiction.
Well, it sends the message to the state legislature who to pick to be electors, and the state legislature will then turn to political parties. Political parties will put forward names of electors, and of course they're going to put forward partisan hacks, right? You don't want to put forward someone who's going to, you know, really think about it and make a decision based on their conscience. You want someone who has always voted Democrat or always voted Republican, and you know that they're a sure thing, so they're not going to vote some other way. So yes, theoretically they can vote however they want. In practice, they're often partisan hacks. So the original sort of idea behind this as a deliberative body that makes the best choice doesn't
Sure.
work. For all of that, I still think it's the best way to pick a president. Almost entirely, because it forces presidents to pay attention to the whole country. If it weren't for the Electoral College, if we went to a direct voting system, the states of California and Texas together could pick the president without the rest of the country. Assuming you could get California and Texas to vote the same way, of course. It forces people who want to be president to pay attention to places that otherwise would have no voice. If you want to think of it as empowering the minority, I think that's a fine way to think of it.
Uh-huh. Or sure. Or it ensures that there is power is distributed regionally.
Right. And again, by and large, the Electoral College has mostly just confirmed the popular vote. There are a handful of times in history when the popular vote and the Electoral College have been at odds, but That's sort of the rare exception that almost.
Sorry, one more thing. And are there formal legal rules, or maybe it depends state by state, upon whether state legislatures are bound to represent the state electoral process in the selection of electors?
Yeah, again, it depends on the state.
Yeah. So 51% vote for the Democratic candidate. It may or may not be the case in a given state that they have to choose Democratic electors.
Right. So Maine and Nebraska, I believe, split their electoral votes up so that if you have that kind of a breakup, or depending on how the vote goes in the state, then you can split the electoral votes. But otherwise, it's usually winner take all.
Yeah. But let's say the Democratic person wins the popular vote, and but the state is controlled by a Republican legislature. What's to keep them from just selecting Republican electors?
The fact that it would be political suicide. That would be the last year that a Republican legislature controlled the state.
But there's nothing illegal about that.
Nope. Unless the state has set its own laws, right? Unless the state has set laws for itself about that.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, no. I think it's a great system. I am in the vast minority on that. Fortunately, it is too difficult to change for it to go away. It would take a constitutional amendment to get rid of it, and I've sort of got inertia on my side there.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us really to sort of the question of if that's how the president is picked, what on earth does the president do? So that's 69 and 70 sort of kick us off with that, Ed. If you want to run with those.
Oh, yeah. So Federalist Papers 69 and 70 were both written by Alexander Hamilton. You might know him as the star of a hit Broadway show.
Yeah.
Before he was a famous Broadway star, he was an important advocate for the federal constitution as it exists. Federalist 69, in large part, just enumerates the powers that are familiar to us from the Constitution itself. So it talks about how the magistrate is to be elected for a period of 4 years. It talks about how the president of the United States is subject to impeachment and the reasons for such. It talks about the president's powers to make treaties, to serve as commander in chief, to appoint ambassadors. But in general, Federalist 69 just sort of enumerates the powers that are familiar to us in the office of the presidency. Federalist 70 spends a little bit more time sort of advocating for that picture of the executive office. And the idea is, so I suppose the debate in general is a debate between people who think that the executive is too powerful and people who think that the executive is too weak. And so Hamilton takes pains to try to show that the executive, as described and laid out in the Constitution, has enough power to govern competently, but not so much power that he can dominate the other branches of government. And the main thing that is going on in Federalist 70 is that Hamilton sort of lays out the four features that are necessary to constitute a competent executive. And those features are unity is the first. Yeah, so the idea with unity is just the idea that you have a single person making the decisions. If there were multiple executives that were sort of regional in nature, then that would dilute power in a way that leads to ineffective government. The second of those ingredients is duration. I guess that refers to the length of the presidential term. I guess the idea is that 4 years is neither too short to get things done nor too long to dominate others. The third ingredient is an adequate provision for its support. That is to say, there were some debates in the time about whether the president should be financially compensated for his or her, but really his, efforts. Hamilton argues for the importance of that to establish a certain degree of independence. And then lastly is competent powers.
Now, Ed, Donald Trump is running for president in part on the platform that he is so rich he cannot be corrupted by that office. So is he basically just saying, you don't need to pay me, therefore I'll be a good president? And if so, should we sort of agree with him on that? I mean, has he scored a point there?
I mean, I think that's silly. I mean, no one, the power that the president has, I mean, nobody, I'm sure there are lots of people who run for president because they're interested in the power that will accrue to them. But nobody runs because of the power that is accrued to them in the terms of their presidential salary, which is how much?
Off
the top of your head?
I want to say
it's under $200,000, isn't it?
I want to say it's $400,000, but that might be cumulative. That might be like all 4 years. I will Google that.
In any case, anybody who is running for president
$400,000 a year with a $50,000 annual expense account and a $100,000 travel account.
A $50,000 expense account.
And $19,000 for entertainment.
Awesome. Man, maybe I should run for president.
Yeah, for real. It's not worth it. That's not enough.
That's exactly right. I mean, you might be enticed by the powers of the presidency, but the powers of the president that are enticing have nothing to do with the salary. It has everything to do with everything else. And I mean, one particular thing about Trump's presidency, I think I saw an article about this, is that because he has business interests around the globe, there would be virtually no president in the history of the United States whose personal interests would be as conflicted as a Trump presidency.
Right, which would be interesting because when you become president, all of those personal interests, you're isolated from those. So you're not allowed to make money. You're not allowed to have a salary outside of your presidential salary. All of that stuff gets sort of set aside, put into a bank account or whatever. So you know, Barack Obama is technically a millionaire, if nothing else, thanks to his book sales. But that's mostly irrelevant because he can't get to it until after he's done being president, which is fine for Barack Obama. Heaven help us, Donald Trump wins election and then wins a second term, he'll be 78 before he gets to ever touch his wealth again. I don't know if no one's explained that to him or if he just doesn't. Again, I think it's kind of an interesting side note. Anyway, sorry to derail with the Trump comment. Basically, that's the intro to the rest of the Federalist Papers and what they have to say about the presidency. They unpack those different components. So Federalist 71 through 77, they unpack the unity, the duration, the pay, and then the competent powers, and then focus on the competent powers. You know, what does the president actually do according to the Constitution? Well, he's in charge of the military in times of crisis. He appoints officials. He is the person who receives ambassadors. These are all, and the Federalist Papers go to great pains to point out that most of these powers are powers that governors already have. So yeah, all things that governors can do. There's nothing controversial about sort of taking that power and raising it to the national level. In a sense, I think they're right. You said, you know, no one runs for president for the paycheck. It's all for the power. But if this were all of the powers that the president had, no one would run for president wanting to do this either, because it's really not that much, right? Assuming that we are not at war or in some kind of national crisis, the constitutional powers of the presidency are very, very, very limited. Even sort of the big gun that he has at his disposal, the veto, can be overridden by Congress. Which, again, there's that sign that Congress is ultimately in charge, which raises the question of what on earth has happened. That is not the way we look at the presidency today. You know, we basically look at the president as if he were the king of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. We even in the way we talk about the interactions between the president and Congress, it's, you know, the Congress is blocking the president from accomplishing his goals, from getting his laws passed. Well, no, it's Congress's responsibility to pass laws in the first place, right? If they decide not to do something that the president wants to do, that's entirely up to them. They're not an obstacle. They're the way things get done, which again raises the question of what happened, how things changed. And I think we see some hints of that in the opponents of the Constitution, the people who suggested that even in its limited capacity, the president has been given too much power. So yeah, so these the anti-federalists again warn of a change that's going to come down the road with the presidency. Now again, they also spend most of their time talking about Congress. They're much more concerned with that, but they do have a few things to say about what's going to go on in the executive branch. So Patrick Henry, for example, talks about the growth of presidential power as this thing that's going to reach and spread from Washington D.C., although it wasn't Washington D.C. yet, from the federal capital to every corner of the country. He talks about, you know, women won't even be able to go into the bathroom and put on makeup without the power of the president sort of reaching into their private affairs and interfering with that. And as I point out to my students, to some extent that's true. At least I assume it is. I've never actually bought makeup, but I assume it comes with like an FDA warning on it. You know, don't poke yourself in the eye or eat this or whatever. That, you know, Patrick Henry was right. The federal government does follow you into the bathroom when you go in to put on makeup. The anti-federalist who writes the most about that is one named Cato, again named after the great Roman Republican. Ed, what does Cato have to say?
Yeah, so Cato, in letter 5 of the anti-federalist papers, just articulates a pretty familiar kind of worry about the power that a single executive would have. So in letter 5, Cato writes, in my last number, I endeavored to prove that the language of the article relative to the establishment of the executive of this new government was vague and inexplicit, that the greater powers of the president connected with his duration in office would lead to oppression and ruin, that he would be governed by favorites and flatterers, or that a dangerous council would be collected from the great officers of the state, that the 10 square miles, if the remarks of one of the wisest men may be credited, would be the asylum of the base, idle, avaricious, and ambitious, and that the court would possess a language and manners different from yours. Right. So the idea there is that in investing this power, and even in some ways the limited power, at least, you know, as you mentioned earlier, that is given over to the executive by the Constitution. Nevertheless, if that power is invested in a single person, then that person is going to be subject to the flattery and seductions of those who are gathered around him in that little 10 square miles of that, you know, that constitutes the Capitol. And so, you know, the avarice, the ambitious, the base, and the idle would be able to win the ear of the president. And if you don't have a single executive, or if you have multiple executives or no executive whatsoever, then there isn't that same kind of a worry about people being able to win the ear of the executive.
Right. Well, I got to ask, which take on the presidency do you like more, based on just the little bit we've been talking about, the Federalist or the Anti-Federalist?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that question, and for what it's worth, for, you know, those who aren't in academia, like, these kinds of issues are really core questions for theorists like Coyle who are in political science departments. Political philosophers like me, who are doing philosophy in philosophy departments, almost never look at institutional questions like this. The questions that we look at are theoretical, but they are wholly different. And so there's a way in which I approach a lot of these questions anyways as an outsider. I certainly don't have any kind of expertise. And, you know, certainly a balance needs to be struck between the ability to get things done and a worry about the concentrations of power, you know? And I think the way in which the Constitution does that is kind of magnificent. At the same time, you know, I would kind of say that, like, I think it's a little bit of a mistake to think that what we really need are this timeless, enduring, unchangeable set of principles that will last for all time. And I sort of worry about the way in which the most effective government for a people is going to depend on the time and the context and the social problems. And then I would just note that, like, 18th century United States was radically different than 20th century United States. It was pre-industrial. Modernization hasn't happened. And just like society is just immensely more complicated than it used to be. And that's lamentable in a lot of ways, but it's certainly also like an amazing, great thing in other ways.
So sort of 18th century United States, they could like handle this republic thing, but 21st century United States, we just need a king or a tyrant or a dictator.
Well, all right, so I can't tell if you're being sarcastic.
I'm mostly not being sarcastic. Because it's right. I mean, the question is: does the office of the president, as established by the Constitution, have too much power? Is it sowing the seeds of tyranny by having such a wide ranging, you know, an office that's even as large as it is? Which, to be fair, in comparison to other executive offices, both back then and today, you know, compared to a king or even a prime minister, our president is really weak, right? The president does not get to pass whatever law he wants to pass, unlike, say, the English prime minister or you know, various other other national executives. The question is, are the Federalists right that, you know, it's enough power, that's how it should be, or are the anti-federalists right that, yeah, it's going to balloon into something worse?
Yeah, so I guess I would say, so my sympathies are federalist sympathies then. And so I would say that in general, it's enough power, it's not too much power. And I mean, and the direction of the shape of the executive in the ensuing 300 years, or what, 250 years now, is in the direction of greater power, and I think that's probably appropriate. And I mean, and just to unpack like that point that I made earlier, it's so easy to lose sight of the fact of like the complexity that exists in contemporary society, and like that complexity is of every sort. So like, it's the complexity of the modern global economy, right? It's the complexity of global interactions. It's the complexity of technology. It's, you know, so you're making that crack about the makeup. But like, should there be any limitations on a makeup company, any kind of liability for a makeup company putting materials or chemicals that they know to be harmful in like, is that okay? Or do we want somebody sort of scrutinizing that? And it's easy to say, oh, this is just – I mean, it's really easy to complain about federal regulations until you really want federal regulations. Like when the water that you're drinking is polluted and dirty, or the air that you breathe, or, you know, there's lead in the soil or whatever. Or there's a global pandemic of some kind, whether it's avian flu or SARS or Zika. It's like you want a CDC.
Oh, sure. But aside from sort of the federalism questions of, you know, state versus national, mm-hmm. Why the president rather than Congress, right? Why the guy who doesn't represent you, as opposed to the people who do? Mm-hmm. So again, that sort of setting aside the questions of whether or not national government should be doing that at all, which is one set of questions within the national government. Congress is the leadership branch. The president is there to sort of enforce the laws that Congress passes. Mm-hmm. Has the president gone farther than he ought to have? The anti-federalists again say, yeah, that's going to happen. The federalists say, yeah, not so much, right? That's not such a big concern. And you've kind of said already, you think, yeah, that's appropriate for where we're at now.
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, I think, again, given the complexity, there are just going to be certain kinds of problems that need to be addressed and that are sort of best addressed by an executive, because legislatures can be slow to respond. They're sometimes out of session. Sometimes there can just be political gridlock that keeps you from solving problems. And then I'll also say that, like, you know, all of the powers that have accrued to the president are powers that were bequeathed to him or her, as the case may be, by Congress, right? So a lot of the levers and switches that a president can pull is in the fact that he directs the executive branch and, you know, in all the various different departments. And all those departments were created by Congress. So, I mean, it's certainly the case that the president has accrued a degree of power that George Washington didn't have. But, like, all of those were given by Congress.
Oh, yeah. And there's no doubt that the problems of a bloated executive branch rest, you know, the fault for that, both in its formation and in its continued existence, rests squarely on the shoulders of Congress. Mm-hmm. That I think is absolutely undeniable. So the big question out of the founding is the question of power and what is the, you know, how should we view the president? Is he an officer? Is his office one that should go out and actively do things and try to make change happen? Or is the president more of a passive office, the presidency more of a passive office, that's sort of only active power is that of acting as a brake on Congress, right? So Congress starts to go too far and the president, you know, drops the veto every once in a while on rare occasions. Otherwise, the rest of the time he's just sort of doing whatever law, enforcing the law that Congress passes, or is it his responsibility to go out and make things happen? Now, obviously, we have a historical perspective on that, but that conversation starts in these Federalist, Anti-Federalist papers. Mm-hmm. The Anti-Federalists are deeply concerned that he's going to be more active than the Federalists suggest he will be. Yeah, question of power. I think that stuff's fascinating, but again, I'm a political scientist. Anything to follow up there?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it is. And those sort of gets to issues about unity again.
Right.
So I think it's probably just the case that there's just going to be certain kinds of problems that you need. I mean, you know, you can think about it. This is going to be a familiar example for both you and me, because we teach at institutions of higher learning. I don't know how much power your faculty senate has.
I don't either.
Why does the university have a president? You know, the body of faculty, you know, we have a faculty forum. We have a certain degree of power. I don't know if I could sort of enumerate exactly what the jure powers of ours is, but, you know, we have a lot of power. Why do we even need a president? And then I think there are a lot of answers to that question. I mean, part of it is in an academic environment, because professors just by and large didn't become professors because they wanted to run an institution of higher learning. It's because they wanted to research and teach. And so part of that is, that's one way it's different. But I mean, the other kind of an issue is just because, unity, to use Hamilton's language. It's like, you got to have unity. You have to have a single person invested with a certain degree of power, just because when that power gets diluted, it becomes a less effective way of responding to problems. So I guess I would just sort of appeal again to that, like, to the value of unity in that way. I mean, could you imagine what would it look like to have a form of government that had no executive whatsoever and was just a legislature? So not even like a parliamentary style of government.
Right. So that's what we had prior to the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
So under the Articles, we had just the Congress, no executive, no judicial branch. There are different arguments about that, right? I mean, there are people who say that it was better because you still have execution of laws. It just falls on the states instead of on, you know, the national government. Mm-hmm. So it's not completely beyond the pale, but it's also generally agreed upon, I think, that, you know, an executive is necessary. You do need someone to enforce the law. But it does become a question, even of separation of powers, when the person enforcing the law is also the primary voice that is proposing laws. Have you now crossed a line? Mm-hmm. Have you gone too far? When the president says something like, I'm going to veto any bill that you don't send me that's not exactly what I want.
Yeah. Oh, so, I mean, so one thing about that. So the role in which the president now has in sort of setting the agenda for setting the legislative agenda for, you know, the coming year, that's wholly traditional, right? I mean, that's just the way that it happens. The office of the presidency has happened to evolve, like
right. Traditional in the, you know, last 80 years or so.
Is it really only in the last 80 years?
Yeah, basically since FDR. Uh-huh. Well, since Wilson to some extent, but FDR is the one who kicks that off. Because uh-huh. prior to him, the reason the president can do that is because he has a staff. He has a large enough staff that are working even when Congress isn't in session. That all kicks off with FDR.
Uh-huh.
So prior to that, the presidential staff was functionally non-existent. The idea of writing up a bunch of bills and having them ready when Congress comes into session, no president would have been able to do that functionally, at least not in any scale that mattered.
Uh-huh.
And since then, there's been sort of this is maybe a minor point that's not terribly interesting to most people, but there's been sort of a arms race, isn't the right word, a bill race to see who can, you know, get the budget written the fastest, because mm-hmm. the congressional party that's out of power, or the congressional party that's in charge versus the president's office, whichever of those gets proposed first has sort of the advantage of, you know, being proposed first, and has all kinds of procedural advantages and so on. And basically, Congress has lost that battle every time because they don't really have the means to have something ready, whereas the president does. So you're right, it is traditional, right? It is in basically living memory of every American. Mm-hmm. That's the way we've been doing it. Mm-hmm. But it is not the way it has always been. And we'll talk about what happened and why that changed.
I mean, I guess to me that just doesn't seem like a big deal. I mean, the president has the power of the veto. The president has always had the power of the veto. Granting the executive that power means that in a certain kind of way there needs to be – well, I mean, it operates as a check on the legislature. You know, how that power gets exercised is subject to tradition, but like that dynamic has always existed. And so the legislature, if they really wanted to, could just be like, no, we write the laws. You can either sign it or not sign it. But it's not as if the president has any novel authority to initiate legislation that wasn't granted by the Constitution.
Right. Well, right. I mean, no more so than anyone else. Again, there are some sort of practical differences that, and again, we can get into that in a bit.
But that bit about being able to whoever gets the budget written first has an advantage. I mean, I kind of understand that, but it's not – so the president's proposed budget is just a piece of paper. Like I could write a proposed budget. It's not like that has any kind of systematic – I mean, he can propose that, but then somebody in Congress – I mean –
Right, so someone in his party in Congress will stand up and propose it.
Yeah.
Right, so there's that party connection there too. But again, there's a rhetorical advantage, right?
First. I understand that.
So, you know, the president can stand up and say, you know, I propose, here's my budget, and in it I include, you know, an extra $1 billion for AIDS research.
Uh-huh.
Well, what happens is often the president's budget will have certain things that are his issues that he cares about. Then the congressional budget from the other party will also include funding for those things, but they'll include less. So, you know, $1 billion for AIDS research. The congressional Republicans might say, well, we're only going to include $500 million for AIDS research. What that matters politically is the president now has the rhetorical advantage of being able to say, look, the congressional Republicans have slashed the AIDS research budget by $500 million.
Uh-huh.
Right. Anyone who studies political science knows that that is just completely untrue, but what does that read like in the papers?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, there are sort of practical political science things that come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we can get more to that. Other thoughts on this?
No. Let's progress.
Yeah. So the big question then is what happened? How do we go from this somewhat restrained, if still active, view of the president to a view of the president that's Well, again, basically that the president is functionally, if not a king, at least more like a prime minister in the popular American mind. Why do we have someone who can promise to build a wall across the border with Mexico? And mm-hmm. a significant portion of Americans seem to think that's like a practical reality. Or pick your crazy liberal promise of choice. You know, free college for all Americans. What's changed that we think that's possible? And there's four big points in history that make that transition happen. So four big historical moments where the presidency starts to swing towards its modern age. Obviously, Washington is the first president. He sets all sorts of patterns that then get followed. He makes the presidency very dignified. Interesting. I mean, we could talk about Washington all day. He answers a lot of the very practical questions, like, you know, what kind of clothes should the president wear when he's out in public? Should he always be dressed to his best, or is it okay to, you know, show up in your garden clothes? Should the president go to parties? Should the president dance when he's at those parties? Should he drink in public? All those questions get answered. But by and large, Washington has a very, very restrained administration that is functionally aristocratic. So if you sort of ask Washington and the next several presidents after him, why should we listen to you, right? Why should we follow your lead? The response is going to be, first of all, the Constitution gives me certain powers, and second, because I am inherently competent and virtuous. Again, that sort of trifecta of law, virtue, and competence that you see in kind of a British view of aristocracy. He may not have said it in quite those words, but that would be the argument that's given for the presidency. Along comes Andrew Jackson. So Andrew Jackson runs for president in 1824 and loses in a contested vote. So the Electoral College does not pick a president. It goes over to the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives picks John Quincy Adams. Ironically, because the Speaker of the House is a guy named Henry Clay. Clay had also been running for president. He gives all of his votes to John Quincy Adams, so John Quincy Adams wins. John Quincy Adams then turns around and picks Henry Clay to be his Secretary of State. From Jackson's point of view, that's just outrageous. That's a cabal designed entirely to keep him out of power. There's, you know, behind-the-scenes shenanigans going on. In reality, that's just what's supposed to happen, right? When the Electoral College fails, the House of Representatives picks the president. That's how it works. But again, from Jackson's perspective, that's not right. So he, working with a brilliant political organizer named Martin Van Buren, basically organizes the first national campaign. So in 1828, Jackson becomes president, running with the argument that the president is the voice of the American people. So the argument is basically, look, Congress can't represent the American people because no single congressman is voted for by all Americans. Mm-hmm. Only the president can sort of fill that popular role. Now, nothing really gets done with that. That isn't carried out to its conclusion by Jackson or by any of the 19th century presidents until we get to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is, in my mind, the great villain here. He's the one who wrecks the whole thing. You are free to disagree with me on that. What Wilson does, Wilson starts off as a congressional scholar, so he's actually a political scientist. Starts off as a congressional scholar and comes to believe that Congress is an 18th century relic, and it's just not possible to use Congress to get all of his sort of progressive agenda items put in place for the nation. He has this kind of wish list of things that he wants to get done. Realizes that Congress isn't going to make that happen. So what we really need to do is we need to scrap Article 1 of the Constitution and put in place something more like the British Parliament, the post-reform British Parliament. And that's sort of where he's at until Teddy Roosevelt becomes president. When Teddy Roosevelt takes office, Wilson has an epiphany, and it's that the president might be able to do what Congress cannot. Given a president who makes good use of technology to speak directly to the American people and who refuses to treat with Congress as equals. He starts to say this is really the way to get things done. The president, as Andrew Jackson had said, is the true voice of the people. That means it's the president's job to lay out a vision for what America should be and convince people that that's really what they deeply believe, even if that's not actually what they believe. So Wilson reestablishes the practice of going to give his State of the Union in person. That had not been done since Thomas Jefferson abandoned it. He takes advantage of technology, so radio is new on the scene by the end of his presidency. He starts taking advantage of technology and working that into his speeches. If you go and look at his State of the Union addresses, it's very clear that he's not actually speaking to Congress. He's speaking to the American people, as evidenced by the fact that once the State of the Union is over, he's sort of done with it. Traditionally, it would be you wouldn't say anything about policy in a State of the Union anyway. It'd just be sort of a motivational speech. But whatever policy discussions that went on would be a discussion. So the president would say something and the political parties in Congress would say something else, and you'd have some back and forth. Wilson doesn't do that. He throws his policy proposals out there and then is sort of done again. And in the minds of the American people, there starts to grow this idea that somehow the president is the one who's in charge. The president is the leader of the national government, because of course he's the one going to Congress giving policy proposals. You don't see the Speaker of the House showing up in the White House giving policy proposals to the president. And again, combined with mass communication, the telegraph and eventually the radio and so on, that idea gets reinforced. And then when FDR becomes president, Congress sort of follows through with that. They start putting in place New Deal programs and then delegating powers to FDR. So they build an executive branch that is large. It looks much more like our modern executive branch than anything in the 19th century before it, and giving him the powers needed to run that executive branch appropriately. And that power is kind of driven home in an apparently permanent form following the end of World War II, when the president's military power, especially his military power, shows that it is now permanent. So for the first time after a war, we don't disband our army. Our military stays in place. And of course, for the first time in history, we now have a weapon that's capable of eliminating an entire nation with, you know, the proverbial press of a button. Those are powers that the president has, right? The president, as the foremost member of our foremost part of our government, is pretty solidly established. Anything to add to that? I know that's a quick overview. That's like 3 weeks of my presidency class in, you know, 10 minutes.
No, that's awesome and really super interesting. And, you know, so I guess I would say this. It's no surprise that the new powers that accrue to the executive, I mean, they happen during times of huge national crises, right? So you have a world war,
a depression,
a second world war. And I mean, I guess I would say, like, in some ways, all of those things are an instance of, like, that social complexity that we get. So it's not an accident that these new powers accrue to the president at that point in history. Because it's like that point in history that we switch from into being like a modern society with all of its complexity.
Well, and I don't even necessarily have a problem with the crisis powers of the presidency. My problem is that the crisis powers then become the normal powers.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then I was just going to say, and so those powers are ushered in by these periods of really national crises, and those crises are really acute in a lot of ways. But I guess then I would just say it's like, but those crises are indicative of the kind of complexity. So even after it's just the case that the world that exists now is just more complicated in a way that a legislature just can't respond to. And so in that way, those things, the depression, the wars, those aren't one-off instances, but those are actually like examples of the different world that we live in. You know, so it's an interesting question, like, what would it have looked like, and sorry, just as a side point, just to, like, your point about the military power, that's sort of one area that makes me a little bit nervous in the way in which
that particular power has accumulated makes me a little bit nervous. I mean, the president can effectively go to war without the declaration of war of Congress, and that's kind of a big deal. But anyways, just like setting that little issue aside, like, what would it look like to deal with the two wars? I mean, maybe let's set that aside because war, that's a special issue. But like, you know, what would it be like to try to confront a crisis like the Great Depression in a way that is led by the legislature?
Right. And again, it's virtually impossible to answer that because that's not how it happened.
Yeah. But can you just sort of like imagine what that would look like?
Yeah. So I think maybe in that case, sort of my ideal would have been basically a sunset clause on all of the changes they made. Right. So we are in a time of crisis. We're in a depression. Things are economically bad. We're going to institute all of these programs, but we're going to put deadlines on all of them so that when we hit this deadline, if the crisis is still going, of course, we have the option to renew. If it's not still going, all of those powers go away. You know, those executive branch offices close up shop and the whatever the program is that we've established, because we're no longer in a time of crisis, it's no longer needed. So mm-hmm. that goes away. The powers, the delegated powers to the president, mm-hmm. revert back to the legislature. And if we need them again, we can pull them out again. Mm-hmm. That's fine. That's one of the reasons we have a president. The existence of crisis powers is not objectionable, I don't think, from a constitutional point of view. I think it's pretty clear that they expect the president is your sort of break glass in case of emergency officer.
Yeah, okay.
And the great example of this is Abraham Lincoln, right? He accumulated phenomenal power during his time as president during the Civil War.
After and then he was shot,
he was shot, and the Andrew Johnson was absolutely not the person to follow in his footsteps.
Oh, yeah.
Johnson tried to sort of be Lincoln ongoing, but he had neither the personality nor the political acumen to do so, and ended up getting impeached. I suspect Lincoln would not have been impeached, but I also think that as soon as he's done in office, Congress takes its powers back. Also, I think in either case, you have a Congress that says, thank you for your service. We appreciate what you've done. The emergency is now over. Mm-hmm. But again, I also think that Congress really is supposed to be in charge because it's the branch that legislates, it's the branch that deliberates, it's the branch that represents. Three things that the president cannot and does not do.
Yeah. Okay. Gosh, this is interesting. So, and then I would just say, like, okay, so modernity. The thing about modernity is that it is a period of inexorable crisis in a certain kind of a way. And so again, I would just say like the nature of the social world has changed. And I guess when I say crisis, I put crisis in scare quotes.
Sure. Because there's always rhetoric. I mean, the rhetoric is always in the time of crisis.
But I mean, the kinds of problems that we confront are the kinds of problems that require a unified executive to direct them. And again, this just has to do with the complexity of society. So it's like the legislature by nature, it just isn't unified that way. And given the nature and shape of our social problems, it's like they can only be attacked by setting like this sort of grand vision. And it's like, and the legislature just can't, it just like, it can't do that.
It can't do that without compromise.
I don't even think it can do that. Or the extent to which it's able to do that just means that certain kinds of powers are accruing to an executive-like figure in the legislature. But you got to have an executive, you know?
Right. So again, I don't think anyone's all there. There's the fringe out there that says we shouldn't have an executive. I don't think anyone's saying we shouldn't have that.
Yeah.
But where should sort of the bulk and burden of our governing fall? Well, again, I think that's on the legislature. And even that's not to say that all delegation is wrong. I think a sign of good leadership is delegation, but limits on delegation, restraint, sunset clauses, you know, all sort of reasonable measures ought to be taken. And I think we're seeing something like this with the war on terror, which for better or worse is not actually an issue that I've followed probably as closely as I should have. You know, the question of privacy. If... if Congress is writing laws governing, you know, what sorts of things the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice can do relative to American citizens in terms of privacy, I don't, you know, we might think some of those laws are unconstitutional, and of course you can have court cases over that, but that's one thing, right? When the Department of Homeland Security is just making up those laws, that's something I think entirely different. Mm-hmm. One of those involves people that I have voted for meeting and arguing mostly publicly in a way that comes to some kind of law that has to pass both the House and the Senate and the presidency. The other of those is decisions made by who knows, implemented by who knows, and enforced by people that I will probably never see unless I'm being arrested for something.
Yeah.
Right, and that to me is incredibly problematic. I like the idea that the people actually making the laws that govern me are people I can vote for or against, rather than faceless bureaucrats. I like the idea that there's an openness and a deliberation that goes on, rather than, you know, whatever the president happens to think becomes the guiding principle for the executive branch. I think those things happen to be valuable and worth preserving. Or we need to just say this Republican stuff is over and we're going to have some kind of constitutional monarchy. I suppose if we go in that direction, that's a different conversation. Yeah. I'm just not quite ready to go in that direction yet.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get you. But, like, again, so the bureaucrats who you're concerned – so, I mean, I'm sympathetic with your worry. The bureaucrats – who are making the decisions were bureaucrats who sit in offices that were created by the legislative branch, right?
Sometimes. The legislature will also sometimes say, hey, create whatever offices you need. So even then, there can
be... Yeah. But even that, I mean, that's granting a blank check.
Sure.
So that's one thing. There's... The president isn't creating those bureaucratic positions. I mean, that's coming from powers that have been granted by the legislature. And then it's like, I mean, you gotta have bureaucrats. It's like the congressional representatives and senators, they can't run these programs. And so, I mean, you can always talk about particular abuses of power in particular cases. But I suppose if we were sort of talking about if we're talking about the general contours of executive power, that's a slightly different thing. You know, so I might be in favor of executive power as a rule, but be willing to agree with you on some particular case that's an abuse of executive power. And there can always be abuses of executive power.
Oh, sure. And I'm talking executive power in general. And you're absolutely right that this is ultimately Congress's responsibility.
Yeah.
So these problems fall back on Congress. I do not disagree with that.
Yeah.
And how on earth to fix Congress is an entirely different question.
Yeah.
I suspect a couple of years from now we'll be doing Congress episodes since it'll be a midterm election.
You know, and I would just say it's sort of like, so, you know, in the case that you were just talking about, yeah, I also worry about those nameless and faceless bureaucrats who nobody ever voted for. But in the case of the Zika virus, I'm really glad that we have these nameless, faceless bureaucrats who nobody ever voted for, who are attempting to deal with the problem.
I haven't followed up. I saw the initial sort of Democrats shutting down the bill, but I haven't followed up with what the executive branch is doing.
I guess Obama is requesting additional appropriations to fund Zika research. So that's one thing. But, you know, even aside from that, there are the funds that were already appropriated that nameless, faceless bureaucrats were deciding what to do with, you know? And then I say thank God for that. And that's just the kind of problem that is endemic in the modern world, and that's the kind of problem that couldn't be addressed by a legislative branch whose power isn't unified.
Right, and I would rather have the inefficiency and the slowness than the efficiency and the lack of responsibility, deliberation, or representation, deliberation.
Yeah, I mean, really, though? I mean, what if...
Yeah.
I mean, and if millions of people die, that's okay with you.
Right. So, you know, what if someone is kicking in, you know, my family's house, and, you know, where's my legislature then? Right there. Again, there's always the example. There's always the particular examples you can find. But in general, right, what is the general thrust of government in a representative republic? Well, that I think needs to fall pretty squarely elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is one of those instances in which I just sort of think that, like, there are no such thing. There is no such thing as totally absolute, like, timeless principles of ideal government. I mean, I think they're sort of broad principles, but the way, you know, the most effective government is always going to depend upon the particular time period.
Well, again, if you want to say where our time period is, republicanism ought to be dead. Fine, that's a different conversation.
Well, yeah, that's not my position. You know, I believe in Republican government, but I believe in Republican government with a,
but not like
executive,
right? So like a sort of an elected monarchy type thing rather than a,
yeah. I mean, sometimes you need, I was going to say a powerful leader. And
hey,
then I realized
you said it. I was going to say it if you weren't. So,
yeah, I do think that we need a powerful leader. Just
you
not
are not allowed to cut this out when you're editing, Ed. I've got you on tape.
No, that's fine. But I believe that you need a powerful executive. I do, given the world that we live in. And I think the executive needs to be more powerful than it was in the 18th century. I mean, I think that absolutely, just because we live in a different world. And we just have different problems that were unimaginable in the 18th century. Like, you can't negotiate a global financial crisis without a unified executive, an empowered unified you just can't.
Yeah, and again, setting aside the problems of Congress, I would say it is better to negotiate in a nation that claims to be a republic, better to negotiate a global financial crisis using your Senate than it is just to have unilateral decisions coming out of the White House.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's crazy.
Well,
so what might that look like? So here it is. We're living in, let's say the financial crisis of 2008. What if that were still going on? What if unemployment right now were 25%? And would you be like, well, this is just the price that we pay for?
Well, I'd probably say we've had, you know, Barack Obama as president for 8 years, so.
Well, I mean, no, because we don't have, I don't know if you saw that latest news about, like, it's not just the unemployment numbers, it's the salary numbers are up, and it sort of looks like.
Well, and it may be here that what we've got is sort of a basic disagreement over what we see the ultimate role of government as being. It sort of sounds like your view is that the goal of government is, I'm trying to think of the right way to put this, sort of professional, kind of pragmatism, if that's the right way to say it. You know, getting the right policy put in place.
Yeah, so that's not a bad way to put it. This is how I would put it. The role of government is to solve problems that cannot be solved by any non-governmental institution.
Right, and I think that is, as you have said, is a very sort of modern way of putting it. You know, Woodrow Wilson would agree with you.
Yeah.
And that, for better or worse, is not the way our Constitution works. The in part because that assumption, well, for one thing, it involves that you know what the solution is, right? So the solution is X, and I don't mean you personally, but, you know, mm-hmm. Anyone who holds that implies, first of all, that the solution is clearly X, right? Whatever the problem is, or problem Y, solution X, and so on. If only we can get someone in who can implement solution X, right? Mm-hmm. Then it'll work. Like that, then we've arrived, our government is functioning the way it should. The basic assumption behind the Constitution, and we should have talked about, I guess, Federalist 10 and 51, is that no one person, no one political party, no one faction, right, no one gathering of people in agreement has the right answer. That there is no right answer. Because by definition, when you say the solution is X, all you're really saying is, I want X to be the political reality. You're taking your own self-interest and sort of flinging it out on the national scene. So the point of the Constitution, the big picture point of the Constitution, which again, maybe we should have just talked about that, is to get rid of that self-interest, to hammer all of that away until we come at better policy than anything you could have come up with or I could have come up with. What I tell my freshman class is that the big secret behind the Constitution is that you do not get what you want. That's sort of the one-sentence summary of the mechanism of our government, is that nobody has the power in this system to impose policy solution X on the nation, because by definition, any one person, party, or faction's policy solution X is theirs. So the mechanism we have to get rid of that is deliberation, is, you know, representative deliberation in the halls of Congress and between Congress and the president and between the three branches of government and between the different levels of government. But it's never what any one person starts out with. It's always something that none of us would have thought up on our own.
It might be, but it might not be. So look, so, you know, that bit about deliberation and all of that, intercongressional and intra congressional deliberation and all that, I totally agree with that. And it's certainly the case that any one person can be wrong, and the likelihood of arriving at a decision that is more informed and closer to the truth improves with deliberation, right? So I totally agree with that. And I would say that nothing that I have suggested so far contravails that, right? Though note, I think it's false to say that, like, nobody. I'm trying. You put the point a couple different ways, but that nobody knows. I mean, sometimes people know, and sometimes people are right. Sometimes you go into a process, and then after deliberation, you change your mind because you realize that your way wasn't better.
Sure. Or, well, again, the ideal is you have to compromise, right? You have to give up something. So,
sometimes you engage in legislative debate, and then everybody says, "Oh, wow, you're right. Let's just do it your way," right?
Yeah, which legislature are you watching again?
Well, look, I mean, that just happens sometimes.
it does. Obviously, there are issues that sort of thing happens. You know, reopening post offices is sort of infamous for that.
Yeah. And sometimes you're forced to compromise, and, like, that's a bad thing, you know? Because the people who you compromised for, it turns out they were wrong.
Sure.
But nothing that I said countervails all of that stuff about the importance of deliberation and whatnot.
Well, other than by definition, there is no deliberation when you have one guy who's in charge of it.
Oh, well, so a couple points there. I mean, that one person arrives at office after a electoral process that involves a lot of deliberation and selection and dialogue. That deliberation still happens. I mean, it's certainly true that deliberation, that I would say that the deliberative process has been eroded. But I would say that those have less to do with the particular powers that have accrued to the executive than it does with just the divisive nature of contemporary politics. But still, I mean, the president needs to dialogue with Congress to get his or her, as the case may be, preferred legislation, needs to argue for it in front of the American people. I mean, you think about something as controversial as the Obamacare. And, like, Obamacare, I mean, one criticism of Obama was that he wasn't forceful enough in making a proposal, right? He just sort of made these broad outlines and said, you guys design it. I just want you to make sure you hit these three marks. But whatever these three, you know, however you want to hit these three marks, that's just fine. And, like, one big criticism there was that, like, Obama was disengaged from the process.
I'd say we're reading different criticisms of the passage of Obamacare, but yeah. The criticisms I tend to hear, which of course I'm on the right, but they tend to be, he kind of strong-armed this through Congress, you know, spent all of his political capital muscling this thing through.
Well, I mean, it was the single most important thing, legislative thing that he wanted to get done. But
right, but what a great example of a train wreck of legislation. I mean, how much of that is still not implemented? Right, I mean, how much of that is still on hold because people haven't read it or the executive branch doesn't know how they're going to implement it? I mean, because there was so little deliberation, because it was this thing that, again, I'm taking the right-wing perspective on this, that was steamrolled through rather than telling Congress, hey, you guys, take the time you need and hammer this stuff out.
So we can disagree about the policy proposals. And it's certainly the case that, like, it was a signature piece of legislation for Obama. But I mean, when you look back at the process, I don't see how anybody can describe it as being rushed. I mean, that whole debate lasted. I mean, it lasted for the better part of a year, and there were all of these different options that was available to Congress. I mean, the issue was that the Republicans just really didn't want the piece of legislation, and it turned into a fight. But you can't say that there wasn't dialogue and deliberation and discussion. And you can't even say that Obama was like, this is what I want, take it or leave it. I mean, he didn't do that. He said, I want something approaching universal health care coverage. You know, here are some ideas, but you guys hammer it out. And one big criticism of the president is that he wasn't more involved in the legislative process, saying, leaning on particular legislators for his preferred sort of vision of how it's going to work.
Well, and again, I would say a difference in perspective, though, because the stuff I read is no, he was leaning on them too much, and you know, didn't really give up anything. You know, what are the Republican parts of Obamacare? I mean, where are the compromises?
Part of the issue there was that, I mean, Republicans, I mean, there's a lot that you could say there. I mean, for one thing, one of the ideas that Obama wanted was Medicare for all. Or, I mean, to have the health insurance system that United States congressmen and senators buy, have that available for every American. I mean, yeah. I think it's hugely false that there were no compromises that were made. I mean, the preferred system was just going to be universal health care. I mean, the whole thing is a compromise.
Okay.
The preferred thing was simply universal health care of some kind, right? Or, short of that, just to allow your average American citizen to buy the exact same health care program that your senator buys. Right? The compromise is that Obama was starting with an idea that was birthed at the Heritage Foundation, and that was most prominently put into action by a Republican governor. It's not a radical program. It's a Republican healthcare program. The so-called radical program is universal healthcare. And I just put radical in scare quotes, so which Coyle could see, but nobody else could see. And then I would say it was congressional and Senate Republicans who weren't willing to play ball at all. There was no version of what Obama remotely wanted that they were interested in, despite the fact that they were minorities in both houses.
Right. And it's – yeah, again, I am the healthcare policy is not exactly my area, but I don't know that you can say here's the spectrum of – socialized healthcare options, pick something on this spectrum and have that count as a compromise, right? I mean, if the option is...
So I dispute the premise. The option that was placed before Republicans was not anything like a preferred progressive healthcare public policy plan.
Well, and I don't know what it was congressional Republicans it was actually that, want.
I mean, unless the Heritage Foundation is somehow a left-wing think tank.
Right. But I mean, if the assuming, I guess, that the Republicans want no federal health care investigation. I don't know that that's true. I have no idea what they want at all. I don't know the Republicans know what they want, so it may be.
I would say that that's a little bit of the problem. But the health care proposal was the Heritage Foundation health care proposal that was instituted by the Republican Governor Romney in the state of Massachusetts. Right there, you're starting with a center. I mean, I would say you're starting with a center-right health care proposal.
Right, and the argument was, yeah, that's fine at the states, but it's inappropriate at the federal level. And I guess we're getting into policy arguments. How do we extract ourselves
The debate was about whether or not that arose out of a process of deliberation. And
right,
I would say that there was plenty. There are plenty instances of deliberation. I would say that to the extent that deliberation was poisoned, had nothing to do with the powers that have accrued to the executive and have everything to do with the divisive nature of contemporary politics.
Right. And I would turn that around and say it is the strong arming of the president in terms of the process without commenting on the content, because, again, I didn't follow that closely. But, again, I think that just reflects that you tend to read more left sources and I tend to read more right sources. So that, you know, maybe it's somewhere in the middle, right? Maybe we need to both give up something and find some acceptable compromise. Good constitutional fashion. How on earth did we get on that?
Well, we've been talking about executive power.
Right. Professionalism versus
slow
and messy and so on.
You put it, I think that's a very perceptive way to put the point, actually. And so we're disagreeing about that, but I think
That's Woodrow Wilson, right? I mean, someone was telling me, I am not a Wilson scholar, but someone was telling me that basically he designed the way most city governments work now, too. So the idea of like a city administrator, right? So you have your elected town council, but then you have your professional city administrator.
Yeah.
And again, the idea being that you want to give your sort of nod to representation, but who really runs things? And again, I think as someone who tends to believe in republicanism with a small r, I'd rather have the messiness and the inefficiency than the professionalism of one guy calling all the shots. I see that as someone who lives in a town that has a phenomenal city administrator. Mm-hmm. Like if our city administrator, you know, wanted to run for Congress, I would vote for him in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. But again, I think there are things that are worth more than professionalism, especially when professionalism usually is just code for I'm going to implement my policy.
I think that's a pejorative way of putting the point. But let me just say this. So how does this populism that's arising now sort of sit with that poetic, romantic, impassioned defense of the Electoral College about half an hour ago?
It is 100 times worse. If I had my way, we would not even take a popular vote. When it comes to the presidency, because the populism, the idea that the president represents the American people is in part the root of most of these problems that we've been talking about, or things that I think are problems and you don't. I think Congress is our representative body. The idea that the president is the voice of the people is simply nonsense in any meaningful definition. If for no other reason other than he's one person. By definition, he cannot represent more than the people he agrees with. And as our elections show, that tends to be slightly over or under 50% of the people, 50% of the voters, not even 50% of the people. So the idea that this one guy represents all of us is just wrong. I'm radically against the wave of populism.
So I don't disagree with that. I think all of my arguments are sort of rooted in the idea of the importance of unification of power in a modern age. But I think you might have misunderstood my point. I guess my point is that so a lot of times you sound sort of very aristocratic and you worry about the people and their ability to make sound decisions, and that's why you like the Electoral College. But now here's an instance in which we're talking about appointing aristocratic professionals to get the job done because we can't trust the people, to put it crudely.
Right.
But now you're against that.
So I don't trust the people. I trust the process that we once had in place. Right.
Uh-huh.
I I trust a process that is designed to cancel out the problems with the people.
Uh-huh.
So this aristocratic professional that you're talking about, what are the claims that are made about that person? Well, he's really going to do what the people want. Right. No one says we're going to hire a bureaucrat to run X department in the executive branch because he's going to do, you know, exactly the opposite of what the people want, or what only a slim minority of the people want. It's always these are done in the names of the people. Again, with that sort of Wilsonian idea of the people are just wrong and we'll convince them of what they really, really want. I trust not the inherent goodness of the American people, not any of that sort of thing. I trust the institutions that we have set up to filter out the parts of us that are very selfish. I trust the things like a town council meeting where you have councilmen of equal power coming from radically different perspectives, but who have to come up with some kind of law, or a Congress that represents the entire nation that covers the spectrum of beliefs and kinds of geographic locations. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, they're going to fight and they're going to be partisan, but they also have to pass a law. One of the big problems is by means of delegation, they've given themselves an out on that. They've abdicated that responsibility, so they no longer have to do that, so they can amp up the partisanship without ever getting anything done. So again, congressional reform is what's truly needed, even when we're talking about the presidency, but we're talking about the presidency. So no populist here.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess in some ways to me, it's sort of like the office of the executive is kind of a little bit like the way in which the Electoral College system exists writ large. I mean, you have the people voting for a empowering a political class that is presumably, you know, aristocratic and informed and professional, and empowering them to do things in just the way that the Electoral College does. And then, and again, just to reiterate, I'm not arguing for monarchy or anything like that. I still believe in divided government and a separate legislature and a separate judicial and all of that. And then I would just say that sort of like, and given that basic context in which there's a legislative body that enacts laws, so the accrual of power to the executive, I think, is a necessary feature of modernity, you know. But anyways, maybe that's clear enough. You know, can I just make one point? It's kind of interesting to me. We were sort of dinged in a Facebook post, I think, by a listener who had almost given up on us because he thought that we were too conventional. And I mean, I guess the idea was just that I was saying things that a progressive always says and that you were saying things that a conservative always says. And I mean, I'm just sort of thinking about this debate. I mean, is a progressive always going to be in favor of an empowered executive and a conservative always going to be in favor of a disempowered executive?
I would imagine it depends on which conservative and which progressive.
Yeah. And then I was going to say, there's certainly going to be a certain kind of leftist progressive that is as exercised, if not more exercised, about the accrual of power into a single person as you are. And so they're going to be, and maybe it's a little bit harder to think of like an ideal case, but the same is probably true in the other direction, that they're going to be, maybe that's not true. Is there going to be a kind of conservative that's sort of into an empowered executive?
I mean, the neoconservatives are all about that, right? I mean, that was not so much George W. Bush's initial platform. That was certainly Dick Cheney's position, though.
So
W started out kind of sadly. So this is just when I was starting to pay attention to politics much more closely than I ever had before. He started out very much more as a traditionalist conservative, right? Sort of a we're gonna kick things back to the states. I'm gonna give power back to Congress. No more of this, you know, policing the world business. And the first few months of his presidency, it looked like he was going to do that. And then, of course, September 11th happened, and things changed radically in the Bush administration. You almost have to talk about two presidencies there, the presidency of the first 10 months and then the presidency of the last 7 years.
But just one thing that strikes me about that is that in some ways it's a little bit of a debate in which there isn't necessarily sort of like a way that progressives see it and then a different way that conservatives see it. And then one of the things that's interesting about that to me is that I think that sort of illuminates this line. I think my position is less like a progressive position than it is like a modernist position. And then I think your position is a little bit less like a conservative position as it is an anti-modernist kind of a position. And so there are going to be, say, modernist conservatives like Cheney and Wolfowitz who are all in favor of an empowered executive. And then they're going to be like anti-modernist progressives who are, you know, who are going to agree with you.
Although they're increasingly rare.
Yeah, that's true. But certainly that's a type. And so it just sort of I think that's interesting and illuminating in a lot of ways. And at least in my case, I think my progressivism, at least, this is going to be more, it very much is like, it's a modernity. It's just like the world has changed. We have social problems that didn't exist in the 19th century. And the only way to address them is by having a government with particular kinds of powers. You know, so if we lived in, you don't need a welfare state in 18th century United States, but we don't live in 18th century United States anymore.
Yeah, so I don't think you need one in the 20th century either. But you might be able to argue that in the 21st century we do. But
I would say that starting with the Great Depression, starting with industrialization, you need a welfare state. I didn't necessarily sort of expect that insight when we started this podcast, but I think that's kind of interesting. So with that said, maybe that's a good time to try to wrap up this particular episode of The City of Man. We will return to these questions as we progress and continue to talk about the presidency and the election that's going on. So you have wasted another perfectly good hour listening to The City of Man. Our show is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. For more information about our show and all the other shows in the family, please visit christianhumanist.org. We are starting to rack up a number of 5-star reviews on iTunes, which is very exciting for us. Please help other people find the show by rating us as well. Please also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And as always, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks.
This land is your land and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.